You're listening to the OCD Stories podcast, hosted by me, Stuart Ralph. The OCD Stories is a podcast dedicated to raising awareness and understanding around obsessive compulsive symptoms. I do this through interviewing inspired therapists, psychologists, and people who have experienced OCD. Welcome to the OCD Stories. So welcome to episode 288. And in this one, I chat with Dr. Liz Forrester. Liz is a clinical psychologist and is based in the UK. And on this episode, we talk about her therapy story, her research into rumination. We discuss normalizing intrusive thoughts, the difference between thinking and thought, the process of rumination, examples of rumination, healthy versus unhealthy distractions, what actually is exposure and response prevention therapy, words of hope, and much, much more. A wide-reaching episode. I really enjoyed chatting with Liz. She's been on my radar for many years, so it was great to finally get her on. And thanks always to NoCD for supporting the show. I deeply appreciate it. If you want to find out more about NoCD and their therapy services, head to go.treatmyocd.com/theocdstories or click the link in the episode description. So thank you to those guys, and of course, as always, thank you to you for listening. I really appreciate it. And without further ado, here is Liz. Welcome to the show, Liz.
Thank you. Thanks for inviting me.
It's good to have you here. And when I get a therapist on or psychologist, I like to hear their therapy story. So what got them into being a therapist and what got them into specifically working with OCD?
It was almost like it was by accident that I got involved in working with OCD. More years back than I care to remember. I had a phone call out of the blue, from someone that I'd had a coffee break conversation with when I was doing a post-qualification cognitive behaviour therapy training course. And the phone call went along the lines of, do you remember that you said once that if there was an opportunity to do some research that you'd be interested? And I had to admit that no, I didn't remember the conversation at all. I said, but go on then. Anyway, there's this post that's coming up, a research post looking at developing therapy for obsessive ruminations. And my first thought was, don't know anything about it. Even though I'd already been qualified for 3 years, I think it was, at that point, my experience with working with people with OCD was quite thin, and I certainly didn't feel I'd had any success with it, so really felt like I couldn't do it. And I thought, actually, if I really know nothing about it, maybe this is a golden opportunity. So it was a fixed-term post just for 3 years on a kind of research grant working with Paul Chalkoskis and his small team in Oxford. And to begin with, I thought, I'll just do it just for a short time because it'll be interesting, it'll be useful. If I don't like it, it's only 3 years. And I got the bug. Nice. I love working with people with OCD. I think because of its endless variety.
Yeah.
So I think that was back in 1994. And here I am, X number of years further down the line, still specialising in working with people with OCD.
Yeah, that's awesome. And when you say variety, do you mean like the different themes?
Yes, the different themes. Yeah. It's almost like while you might recognise particular themes, everyone has their own idiosyncratic take on it. And just the kind of the mixture of things. And it continues to interest and fascinate me and challenge me in ways that I really feel quite humbled by being allowed this really intimate access to people's kind of deepest recesses of their minds.
Yeah. Wow. Well, thank you so much for sharing that. It always amazes me how different therapists or psychologists get into it. So the first question I wanted to ask you is particularly around intrusive thoughts. So there you said, you know, it's the access to like the deepest parts of their mind, and intrusive thoughts can be very troubling and scary and much more than that. And when working with clients, how do you normalize these thoughts?
Well, thinking is what brains do. We all think. It's a basic part of being human. One thing that I've noticed in working with people is that there's quite a lot of most of us, I say most of us because I would also include myself in that, until I kind of developed a kind of better understanding, that we use the term thinking and thought interchangeably. So, and by doing that, we're not being terribly kind of discerning about what's going on in our mind. In part, I guess, you know, none of us have we haven't got a handbook that tells us about how these invisible things kind of function. So we're bombarded by thoughts all the time. You know, from the moment that we wake up, actually, my theory is that even dreams are kind of nocturnal intrusive thoughts. Some of the thoughts we've kind of chosen to have, and that's more kind of the thinking about things. Other thoughts just occur as kind of random occurrences. You know, all the time we're being kind of bombarded. It's almost like having ping pong balls thrown at us the whole time, thought after thought after thought. Even while I'm having this conversation with you, I'm experiencing kind of thoughts that you might describe as being intrusive. I notice the traffic. I'm thinking, oh, I've got an itch on my back at the moment, maybe a random thought and a memory from the past, that we get these kind of thoughts all the time. For the most part, we just kind of let them go, unless it's kind of useful to us in the moment. But every now and again, a thought might come along that you think, maybe this is it. Maybe this is important in some way. And in OCD, that tends to be, in particular, thoughts that go against the way that we kind of see ourselves as a person. So if you're quite a gentle, peace-loving person, maybe having a violent thought. That in itself might not be enough to kind of get you caught up in the thoughts. But if you then have another one, and then you think, I'm not sure why I'm having these thoughts, and you start looking out for them, then you begin to perhaps notice more and more of them, and perhaps then start to take precautions trying to avoid triggering the thoughts. The nature of compulsions in OCD was always traditionally kind of defined as being kind of overt, kind of visible behaviours and rituals, such as washing and checking. It was the recognition that these compulsions that we do in our head, these covert compulsions, it was that recognition that led to important developments in making the treatment of OCD more effective, in particular for people whose who didn't fit the washing checking kind of protocol for OCD. In over 30 years of practice, I haven't come across a single person who doesn't ruminate. So we don't usually identify rumination as a compulsion. And I think that's one of the reasons why people traditionally have taken so long to come forward for treatment if their key concern is obsessional rumination, because, like we said earlier, thinking is something that we all do. And I think also mental health professionals don't always recognise rumination, this ruminative style of thinking, as being a compulsion either. Because we all try to think our way out of problems. We do that all the time, you know. But in OCD, it's like the use of thinking solutions is very much a part of the problem altogether. So why does it become so compelling? I suppose one of the reasons is if we don't know how else to solve the problem, whatever the problem might be, I guess it feels like we're at least doing something. Whereas kind of striving, you're working it out in your head and trying really, really hard, maybe with this idea, oh, if only could get to the bottom of this. It relates to all kinds of things, but in particular, it seems to relate to obsessional concerns. And of course, you know, doing something always feels better than doing nothing, even if doing the wrong thing, even if it's doing the wrong thing and it's unhelpful.
Yeah, true. I think, yeah, when you're so flooded by anxiety and you've got all these thoughts, you it's a natural to ruminate, right? Because like you say, I'm trying to figure this out. I need to find
an
answer.
That all the time, yeah, don't we?
Exactly. Yeah. And not, you know, as you say, not just OCD, you know, someone cuts you off in the car, you're replaying that, you know, did I do something? Were they in the wrong? Were they?
Yeah. But at some point we recognise, actually, I've had enough of this. I'm just going to put that down. Mm. And that's the whole difference between having a thought, did I cut somebody up in the car, to I need to work this out. Yeah. What if I had cut them up? What if they're really angry with me? I need to make sure that I don't do this sort of thing again. That's the rumination side of it.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's come up on this podcast not too long ago, but it was only ever briefly mentioned in the last 5 years on the show. And as you've stated there, it's such a key part of most people's OCD as the compulsion. But as you say, it's thinking and thought, rumination, I think, could easily be seen as like a thought, or a thought process, but it's actually, it's something you're doing. It's something that's happening. Although it's in your head, it's an act, right?
It's about having that, separating the two. There's the discrete event of a thought occurring, like the ping pong ball being thrown at you. But we have a choice over whether we pick the ball up and examine it. And that's the rumination. That's this kind of process part of it. And it's this, I think third wave CBT has really kind of helped us kind of expand into new ways of working with OCD. I think it was always there kind of implicitly, but now we have, it's almost like we have a better vocabulary for it through kind of mindfulness. And again, it's not about trying to fix anxiety at all, but it's about recognising when I have a thought, I don't have to respond to it.
Yeah, I don't need to engage. And just for the listeners, third wave CBT being sort of ACT, acceptance commitment therapy, or?
Yes, I was thinking mostly ACT. Yeah. Rather than kind of mindfulness per se.
Cool. Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, thank you. So, so someone's come in your room, and as you said there, maybe a lot of people over the years haven't identified that what they're doing in their head is a compulsion, is a part of OCD, and therefore they haven't come to get assessed or treated. But let's say someone's sitting in your room, they've most likely at least somewhat figured out it's going on. But how do you kind of draw their attention to the processes that they're doing inside their own mind versus, like, it's obvious if they know they're washing their hands, right? But how do you make it more obvious that they're mentally washing their hands, if that makes sense.
If we're doing this by video, I've got a nice little practical demonstration that I do, usually with bits of torn up paper, to demonstrate the difference between, you're just going to have to use your imagination here, maybe. Yeah. It's like ripping a bit off, thought, and then you pick one up. Oh, hold on. This thought, maybe it's one with a little square corner to it. This thought seems different to the others. Now, this is the process of thinking about it. We're assessing, we're analysing, we're considering, we're maybe worrying. Worrying is also a process. So we'll begin to look at kind of thoughts like that. We might do a little bit of an exercise, just kind of looking in our thoughts and just identifying what a range of thoughts that we might have, but we don't act on all of those thoughts.
So I had myself muted there. So the just visualizing your tissue paper example, toilet paper, you're just kind of ripping each thing. It's just a thought, it's meaningless seemingly, and then but now we've picked one up and we're engaging, we're looking at it, we're examining it, questioning it, and that's rumination.
Might also make you think, actually I need to look out for other thoughts like this, because I can accept that one unwanted thought is just random. What if I'm having lots of them? What does that mean? What does that mean about me? So we're already getting into the territory of labelling particular thoughts as being more dangerous than they actually are.
Yeah, good point.
Thoughts are just kind of random events.
Yeah, very true. And it brings to mind the, you buy a red BMW, for example, mm-hmm. and then suddenly that red BMW is everywhere and you didn't mm-hmm. notice it 2 days ago.
You thought you bought something really unique.
Exactly. And I guess with intrusive thoughts, as soon as you engage with one, you're telling your brain, this is important. Show me it more. I want to see it more often.
And once we've had that idea, how can we not notice it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so if I said, okay, so then Stuart, stop looking at red BMW, stop noticing them.
Yeah.
For one thing, you have to tell yourself what it is that you don't want to be looking at. So you're going to be thinking about red BMWs all of the time.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I'm picturing one now, so that shows you.
I'm picturing red cars. What make it is, I have no idea, because I couldn't tell you what the shape is.
Fair enough. Okay, so sticking on rumination for a second. So next question. So now we've kind of identified it, and I really like the tissue example. And obviously, if you're doing it in front of them, it's going to be powerful. How do you start? So, reducing physical compulsions, whatever they are, most of my listeners will be able to kind of understand how to do that. But with rumination, how do you get your clients to start to be able to reduce it, stop it, or not engage with it?
I think in the first instance, it might be more useful to talk about why rumination isn't helpful.
Yeah, please. Yeah.
Okay. Just from a clinical perspective, it really seems that rumination is more prevalent where concerns are connected with something that hasn't yet happened, like imagining an event in the future or something that happened in the past, usually the more distant past, that isn't kind of amenable to kind of doing a physical check on stuff. If I was concerned that there might be, I don't know, a hazardous substance in my house, I could go back and check it. But if it's a doubt about a house that I lived in many years ago that maybe has now been demolished, I can actually go and check that. So we can get kind of hooked into trying to work it out in our head in that way. And rumination also seems to attach itself in particular to for doubts about abstract concepts. For example, will I burn in hell for all eternity? How can I be certain I really love my partner? Because those kind of questions, it's really difficult because it's impossible to achieve certainty in a concrete way. They don't have an absolute answer. So we can get caught up in this absolute vicious spiral and struggling to try to reach a satisfactory conclusion about it actually leads us to feel even more doubtful. Okay. I also think it's interesting how rumination often leads to further worries that we hadn't thought of before and can create even more what-if questions when we try to answer them. And that, of course, then makes the process even longer. So you might think, I just need to get the answer to this, you know. So rumination often leads to further worries that we haven't even thought of before. For example, if you're having a doubt whether or not you'd reversed into another car in the car park, and you're trying to get this clear picture of something that hasn't happened, the more that you're trying to think about that, the more we kind of elaborate the image. And you might then think, oh, well, if I didn't reverse into a car because I can't see any kind of scratches on my car, maybe that's because I reversed into a person. So again, it kind of just fuels it further and further. Yeah, so there's that whole combination of this overthinking or analysing. It increases our intolerance of uncertainty. We often overestimate the risk that's involved because if we've pictured it, then things seem more kind of dangerous somehow, don't they?
Mm.
Yeah. Rumination is, in that way as well, kind of it increases our anxiety or lowers our mood, maybe even both, because if you can't find the right answer, it's kind of just becomes another OCD trap, doesn't it?
Yeah.
And this emotional reasoning, if it feels dangerous, it must be dangerous. And if we kind of act on that.
Mm-hmm.
A really fascinating aspect of rumination is the way in which increases the likelihood of having similar thoughts again. It increases, it just kind of strengthens neural pathways, a bit like hearing the first line of a nursery rhyme from childhood. Mary had a little
lamb.
It's impossible not to think it, even if I was thinking tot of whiskey. But anything that we overlearn, it pops into our head with such ease. That's how we learnt our timetables at school, wasn't it? 6 6 is our...
Oh, I never learnt it, so... Because my maths was my weakness, so... I could
guess that's the 6 times table, but then that's me done. So if we overlearn something, if we're always kind of bringing on a particular thought, it makes it more likely that we're going to have that thought again.
Hmm.
This seems to work in two ways. First of all, if we're kind of rehearsing the thought, it kind of prevents the natural, what's called decay of memories of actual events. You might recall a specific event that's been kind of associated with obsessional concerns. It might be something like, oh, I lost a packet of paracetamol on the bus. If you intentionally bring it to mind regularly, it doesn't just fade away, does it? It's kind of there because you've kind of rehearsed it. So it doesn't just become a distant memory, as would happen with many kind of autobiographical memories that we don't attribute a special meaning to. And secondly, it creates memories, but the memory is of a thought, not of an occasion.
Yeah.
I'm going to tell you a funny story. When I was a teenager, it's almost embarrassing to talk about, I had very hairy legs. And my parents went out on a Saturday evening and I thought, I'm going to borrow my dad's razor to shave my legs. And it was one of these old-fashioned metal razors. I think it was quite heavy. And with my soapy, slippery hands, when I was shaving the fronts of my legs, it slipped out of my hand. I ended up with a nasty gash down the front of my shin. I thought, I felt really embarrassed about it, but I was also really scared because my dad had a bit of a temper, and if he knew that I'd been using his razor to shave my legs, he would go absolutely ballistic. So after bandaging my leg up, I thought, I've got to come up with a plausible excuse for why I have this injury. So I thought about it and I said, okay. The story that I told my parents was that I'd been making a sandwich and we had these little very sharp knives, vegetable knives in the kitchen. But I'd used one of those to slice the tomato and it slipped out of my hand. Mum and Dad were quite sympathetic about it. So Dad said I should be more careful, but whew, got away with it. So I didn't get into trouble for the blunt razor. When I went back to school on Monday, I still had the dressing on my leg. And, of course, my friends said, oh, what have you done to your leg? I was too embarrassed to say. Actually, what I did was borrow my dad's razor and I've cut my leg. So I gave them the same story about the tomato knife. It's only a few years ago... my old school friend, we'd had a bit of a get-together, and she says, oh, I remember that time when you cut your leg with a knife. Mm. And I laughed and said, actually, that wasn't true. She says, what do you mean it wasn't true? So I explained it all to her. But the funny thing about it is, whenever I think about that event, what do I picture? I don't picture the razor, I picture the little knife. I can picture exactly where it would be kept on the countertop at home. It was next to the cooker. It had a wooden handle with a little rivety bits in where it gets a little black stains. I have such a vivid image of that. The knife that didn't cut my leg. It has some parallels there with kind of obsessional worries, doesn't it? That particularly when you have thoughts like, you know, did I run somebody over? That you're kind of picturing in your mind somebody that you haven't run over. And the more that you kind of trot out this memory over and over again, it puts kind of flesh on the bones each time. And it makes it very hard not to picture it in that way. And it just becomes so real.
Really, yeah. Yeah, well, good story. And it makes me think of subtype real event OCD, where there's something that actually happened in the past, was probably fine, but now people, where they've relayed it over and over again, and what happens if I did something bad, or what happens if it wasn't actually how it was? And you've gone over it so many times, you don't even know what the truth is anymore.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And then how do you ever know the truth? Because you've replayed it so many times. It's like scratching a vinyl record. You've lost the grooves of the actual record.
There was some interesting research. I can't remember who it was by, unfortunately, where with some student participants, they were kind of manipulating kind of autobiographical memories and got the participants to bring in some kind of some old family photos of them doing particular things. So they were presented with the photos and they had to kind of just give the narrative around what was going on in this photo. Can you explain what you were doing? And then they repeated it several times over, and then they started to insert some manipulated images. And it might be, you know, the original images might have been something like, oh, being in a rowing boat on holiday. And then they'd show photos of, say, the person in a hot air balloon, even if they hadn't done that. So first of all, when they're presented with it, they'd say, oh, that's, no, that can't be my photo, but is that you in there? Yes, yes, it is, but I've never been in a hot air balloon. But with repeated presentations, they found that we're very likely to start to construct a narrative to try to explain to ourselves something that we can see, but there's this almost like a reality gap between our memory and what we can see in the picture.
Yeah, that's fascinating.
Yeah, and I just wonder how that kind of fits with our obsessional thinking and the constant ruminating and the way that we kind of build things up and make it seem more real. Mm. I mean, it is the case that kind of rumination, that kind of keeps us locked into our own sort of internal world of thoughts and maybe prevents us from taking constructive action and just living in the real world. I think the pandemic situation, it's almost like we're all having kind of lived experience that's not dissimilar to having obsessive worries. But the more that we can retreat from the world outside, the more scary it becomes. And we've all had during lockdown, lots of people have had the experience of maybe not setting foot very far outside the door. And then we can only imagine what it looks like. I mean that in a almost like a nightmarish sort of way.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm sure it's even for me, I guess with COVID, like it didn't affect me too much, but like I guess as an example, even when they started lifting lockdowns and I was able to go out, I was still treating everyone like they had the plague. You know, I was keeping as much distance as I can, even though now I'm double vaccinated, and I was still like working through that distrust almost that I've learned.
This sort of tracking, you know, that you go out and you touch something and that maybe you haven't been able to sanitize your hands or wash them, and you're kind of thinking, okay, I've touched something, therefore I won't touch my nose, or, you know, I'll be careful, I'll only hold my mask by the elastic, and when I come in the house, the first thing I'll do will be go and wash my hands.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's an interesting example of just behaviorally how we learn and hopefully how we unlearn. Like, I'm much more calmer now and I haven't necessarily done anything, but going out is an exposure, right? And it's and I can say that it was easy for me because it was never too hard, you know, I wasn't too anxious about it.
But for all of us, the thoughts have been there, haven't they?
Exactly.
And I guess for all of us, that we've spent some time just in this internal world of how dangerous things seemed outside. But then, of course, by spending too much time living in our own heads, thoughts and reality kind of become fused together. Mm. So if we're constantly looking in on ourselves and our feelings, we don't see things then as they really are, and we get entangled in this world that seems fraught with dangers and threats. So the more we kind of start to venture out, and you see, actually, some people seem to be quite happy walking with a friend in the park, or there's some people there sitting enjoying a drink outside a cafe. Maybe I could do that too. I've sometimes wondered whether, as a consequence of OCD, if we spend too much time focusing on our worries, it prevents us from having other kinds of thoughts, the nice or interesting or creative thoughts that might kind of distract us from our worries. distraction for me falls into two different camps. There's distraction with a small d, which is kind of the healthy, helpful distraction, becoming absorbed in something, enjoying reading a book or sort of immersing yourself in a work project or whatever it might be. And that's a good way to allow ourselves to be distracted. But distraction with a capital D is, I don't want to have these thoughts. I need to keep reading. I'm going to really, really focus on this television program so that I don't have these thoughts that I don't like. And that's not very helpful, because the harder you try not to think something, the more likely you are to think about it.
Yeah, and yeah, absolutely. And that comes back to us talking about ACT earlier, because the little d reminds me of values. You know, it's why am I doing this? It's, or even if it's the TV, why am I watching the TV? It's because actually this new David Attenborough documentary is on and I love animals and I want to, you know, I don't want to be with my thoughts and feelings right now. I have to zone out.
Instead of trying to keep our thoughts at arm's length and be constantly pushing them away, or conversely, looking at them so closely and examining them in such detail that we miss out on the wonderful mix of stuff.
Yeah.
So in ACT, it's often referred to as holding a thought lightly. So rather than kind of grasping it and kind of trying to squeeze the life out of it, if we're holding a thought lightly, what we're not doing, or sorry, what we're doing is we're not giving it too much importance. So it might be along the lines of, perhaps I have killed someone. What an interesting idea. And just carrying on with what we're doing. Or maybe just agreeing with the thoughts. Yes, I probably did. And leaving it there. Yeah. And many people find that really quite liberating, this idea that you can, that it's okay to have all manner of thoughts and it really isn't important.
Yeah, absolutely. It's I guess I got an image of like a puzzle, and it's realizing that it's a puzzle, but it's a puzzle that doesn't need to be solved. And if you don't solve it and you leave the puzzle pieces there, it disappears eventually sometimes. And it may come back and you leave it again. You don't engage. You don't try and put the pieces together, i.e. rumination. Okay. So my question before was about how do you get your clients to start leaving that puzzle alone, so to speak, not engaging in rumination? And that was obviously one part you just said around ACT. Is there anything else you kind of help them start to kind of cut it out, so to speak?
By working together to develop a shared, I'm trying not to use the word formulation because it just feels so technical. What could I call it instead?
Plan.
This kind of shared understanding or sort of flow chart, which kind of goes through the whole process of what happens from experiencing an intrusive thought to trying to identify why that thought seemed important to them, and what they then do to try to kind of fix the thought, either think it through or try not to have the thought or engaging in some other behaviours. And also developing a better understanding how some of the strategies that we might use then are counterproductive, like trying not to have a thought. That's from hiding to nothing there, or trying only to have good thoughts, or trying to make us feel completely certain. Because the more we try to make ourselves feel completely certain, the more we have doubts. Chris Tarrant on Who Wants to Be a Millionaire kind of really capitalised on that, if anyone saw the programme back in the day, where it's usually when people are getting close to the jackpot, this, and so what's your choice, do you think? What colour is a zebra? And you thought, it's black and white. Are you sure? Are you completely sure? And even if you know categorically that it still plants a seed of doubt. The zebra in my head is looking more like a chameleon. It's currently green and orange, but
sorry, go on.
Yeah, and so looking at those kind of things, but also looking at kind of attention and reasoning bias, there's a question that's commonly asked is, why do I keep having these thoughts? If they're not important, why do they keep coming back to me? Mm. And it comes back to your red BMW thoughts, when something becomes personally relevant to us, and especially when it has some connotations of threat, we're going to be on the lookout all the time.
Yeah, absolutely.
And also, we can't unthink things that we've thought either, can we? So when you've had a thought about something, although it's an interesting question that I've often been asked, which is how have I managed not to develop worries, excessive worries, about stuff that ideas that people have kind of introduced to me over the years through working with them. And I guess the answer to that is I do have thoughts about it. There are some ideas that I, you know, things that had never occurred to me that will pop into my head. The one that's popping into my head at the moment is non-stick frying pans. Not that I want to put the frighteners on anyone at all, but someone once told me in therapy that their particular concern was about the chemicals in non-stick pans. So whenever I get a frying pan out of the cupboard, this thought invariably pops into my head. But the difference is, I'm happy for that thought to be there and I'll still use the pan. So it's making space for those thoughts, making space for those uncomfortable thoughts, making space for any kind of anxiety that might accompany the thoughts, but still living your life in the way that you want to live it, that fits with your values.
Yeah, absolutely. My thought around the non-stick pan that's coming up for me now is, oh yeah, what happens if that person's right? But then the other part of me is, they're so easy to clean that the pay that my value is ease of life, and therefore non-stick pans make my life easy.
I have that one too.
It's a good example. Okay, no, that all of that was brilliant. I got a question for you around ERP generally. So where's it gone? Yeah, so I wanted to ask you, what is exposure really about?
On occasions, people have been put off by therapy because they've heard of exposure and response prevention, because it sounds so terrifying. So if you have, say, someone whose fear is around HIV and AIDS, you know, their fear might be, well, do I have to expose myself to this disease? I couldn't possibly do that. I don't want to put my health at risk. I don't want to put other people's health at risk. I just couldn't manage to do that at all. In therapy training, we're always told that we should never ask other people to do things that we're not prepared to do ourselves.
Yeah.
So yeah, I'm happy to do all kinds of things. I'll stick my hand down, usually well kept loose. I hope that would be my preference. But I'm not going to stick my, I'm not going to cut my finger and stick it in a vial of contaminated blood. Absolutely wouldn't do that. So why would I ask someone else to do it?
Yeah.
But that's not what it's about. It's not about exposing ourselves to the danger. It's about exposing ourselves to thoughts about the danger. A key part of my approach to therapy is doing things that I call it doing things the anti-OCD way. So doing things that kind of seem a bit kind of extreme, a bit left field, that kind of go beyond what most people would do. And sometimes they seem, you know, a little bit unusual. So, and in particular, I got some ideas to work with, looking at the kind of things that people would avoid doing. So someone with relationship OCD, for example, might find it very triggering to watch a rom-com on the telly, because it triggers kind of thoughts about relationships. Might not even listen to the radio, because there are so many love songs on the radio, or breakup songs in particular, say.
Yeah.
If we don't struggle with OCD, we'd kind of happily watch whatever turns up on the telly, even if not particularly interested in it. We'd listen to all kinds of music, even if you think, oh, I don't particularly like this kind of schmaltzy stuff. But from an anti-OCD stance, we might do things like put together a playlist of breakup songs and to play it kind of constantly. Either on your headphones or just when you're doing stuff. Because again, it triggers kind of thoughts. A real aha moment for me, just about the power of doing these kind of things and how we kind of fuse with thoughts, and how kind of the reality gets clouded, was working with a guy who had a lot of concerns about contamination with dog poo, and would kind of check all his clothes if he'd been out for a walk, and taken his kids out to play football, didn't really like to go on the grass. So he would kind of under duress, but there was this whole checking thing. But everyone had to take their shoes off in the hall, and they'd be put on some newspaper, sort of clean paper, just so that it didn't get trailed through to the rest of the house. They were kind of brainstorming about the kind of things that he could do, and we'd sort of talked about the fake dog poo, and I had the thought, why don't we have some pictures? It's amazing what you can find on the internet. I thought, let's get some pictures of dog poo. Why don't we print them off? Clean piece of printer paper with a picture of dog poo. And that each child and himself could have a sheet of paper with some dog poo, a dog poo picture on it. And he had a bit of a chuckle about it and agreed, yeah, that would be the way forward, because it certainly would give him thoughts about it. And the following week, he said he just couldn't do it. Just couldn't do it. So what is it then about a picture of dog poo and contamination? It's a fresh, clean piece of paper.
Yeah, it's the thought, right? It's the...
It's absolutely the thought.
It's mental contamination as opposed to physical.
Yeah.
Hmm. Yeah,
I just thought that was... Yeah, maybe I was just being dim about it, but it really kind of hit home about the importance of exposing ourselves to these thoughts and ideas, and that's what we need to do, which is kind of build resilience to this whole mixture of bizarre, grotesque, disgusting thoughts. Yeah. And sometimes it's easier than others. I don't think there's anyone who could, I don't know, you mentioned David Attenborough and wildlife films. I don't think anyone would be able to sit and eat tuck into a plate full of spaghetti while they're watching something that involves maggots, for example.
Yeah.
And again, that's an example of how we kind of fuse between the experience that we're having and something that kind of reminds us of it.
Yeah, absolutely. Just millions of examples coming into my head. No, that's really, really good. So I've just got a couple more questions. Have you got sort of 10 minutes?
Yes, I'm fine. Yep.
Okay, cool. So slight change of speed. I always like to ask therapists or clinicians words of hope. So the podcast is sort of parents and family members, but it's and therapists, but it's predominantly people with OCD. So are there any sort of words of hope that you have for those people?
There are always things that we can do to help ourselves have a better life. But we also need to be willing to accept the discomfort and the reality that we'll always have worries, we'll always have anxiety and uncomfortable feelings. But if we can kind of make space for those things and build up our resilience to it, it's all part of this process.
Yeah, no, really good point. A very different question now. So if you could pick up the phone and call the 20-year-old Liz, what would you tell her?
Ooh, I certainly tell myself to buckle down and work a bit harder at my studies. I would tell myself to stop worrying about how things are going to turn out, just to make the most of experiences and opportunities that present themselves. There will always be times when our internal critic will be screaming at us and raging and telling us, I can't do that. But we owe it to ourselves to just give it a go. Let's just see how long we can't do it for.
Yeah.
That's how it kind of started off with, I don't think I could work in research with people with OCD because I don't know what to do about it. Well, let's see how long I can't do this for. And well, it's more years than I care to count.
Yeah. Good point. And then you've got a billboard in London. What do you want written on that billboard for everyone to see?
Slow down, take time to enjoy the amazing things that are around us in the world.
Mm.
And leave your electronic devices at home.
Yeah. Good point. Unless you're listening to this podcast, then take it with you.
Yeah. I'd also say, don't listen to podcasts just before you go to sleep.
Yeah, that's fair. last question. Is there anything else that you wish you could have said today?
No matter how long anyone has struggled with OCD for, even if they've previously had treatment that hasn't had the results that they'd hoped for, never give up hope. We're never too old to change. We're never too old to learn how to do things differently. And there are new developments all the time and different ways of just making life better.
Yeah, amazing point. Well, then lastly, thank you so much for your time and your wisdom on rumination. I know it's a topic people are interested in, so I'm sure it will resonate with them.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this week's podcast. If you enjoy the OCD Stories podcast and would like to support us with a one-time tip/donation, please go to theocdstories.com/support. All tips, no matter how large or small, are greatly appreciated. Please subscribe and rate the show wherever you listen to the podcast. And thank you to NoCD for supporting our work. If you want to find out more about NoCD, visit go.treatmyocd.com/theocdstories. And quick disclaimer, guys, this podcast is not therapy. It is not a replacement for therapy. Please seek treatment from a trained professional. And until we speak, take care.